This is The End User, episode 165 for Tuesday, March 25th. Project Morpheus. The game is in you. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr.
Taylor, we dropped a week in there somewhere, and
we did. It was a very merry St. Patty's Day.
That's right. You were at the bar, and as such, you were incapacitated and could not do the show.
Let's go with that. Yeah.
No. There wasn't a lot of news last week, so we decided we'd skip last week and double down on this show this week. So here we are. We've got plenty of news to talk about and a fresh crop of tech news.
That's right. We do. The big one is an announcement from Google. They are launching their own, a smartwatch platform.
Yeah, and this looks kind of interesting. I think they've got some ideas that, if implemented well, could be good for the nascent smartwatch industry as it is. So the thing that gets me a little bit is that we don't really know what this thing is yet.
No, that's right. We don't. We only know that it's a platform and that Motorola and LG are very much looking forward to releasing products on that platform.
Yeah, and we've got some like screen renders of what the watches are going to look like, at least from those companies. We've got a couple other companies that have said that they are going to release watches. Among them are Asus and HTC and Samsung and the previously named LG and Motorola. And also Fossil is looking to get into the game as well. So that's an actual watchmaker getting into a smartwatch device if they end up actually releasing a product.
Yeah, I think Fossil has always tried to be at the forefront of these smartwatches. When Microsoft came out with their Spot Watch system, there was a Fossil version of it as well.
Yeah. So in the show notes, we've got a link here, and there's a little ad that you can watch that is kind of expressing the Google vision of what a smartwatch can be. And if you watch that, I thought there were a few silly things in there that I don't think smartwatches are good at. First of which, there's a guy on a bus, and he gets a text message, and you know, it says something like, "Where are you?" And he replies to it with his voice. "I've been on many a bus in my day, Taylor, and you should probably not use voice-to-text while you're on a bus. It's a faux pas."
Yeah, probably not. I find that using any sort of voice-to-text or Siri is more confusing than it should be when anyone else is around.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, this goes back to the idea of, you know, that guy with the Bluetooth is crazy, right? It's the same thing manifested in a different way. I always, when I take a call, which is not very often, on my Bluetooth headset, and there are people around me, I'll just kind of like hold my phone out in front of me. Just as a social cue.
Just so everyone knows.
Yeah, so people know that, listen, I'm on the phone. It's not your turn to talk to me. I'm talking into the ether, right?
So in a few years, will it just be commonplace for people to start speaking to their watches?
Maybe. I don't know. You know, obviously, it's hard to predict the future. You're the one who's in the future.
Well, it's definitely better to speak to your watch than it is to your glasses.
Yeah. But at least the Google glasses, for the moment, are identifiable in that they are still nerdy enough looking that people can identify that you are, in fact, wearing something that has a camera on it and can accept voice commands.
You'd be surprised. I saw some wearing some the other week, and nobody seemed to really notice except for me.
So the next thing that I think that I saw in the ad that was confusing to me was there was a pair of women waiting in line at a concert or something like that, and they were playing music on the watch. Faux pas number two.
Yeah, definitely don't play smartphone music when you're at a concert.
Have you ever had the experience where you're on or in some kind of public space and somebody is just listening to their ringtones?
No, just for fun?
Yes, like not even music, just listening to ringtones for the hell of it.
I may have done that once in 2001, but that was it.
Oh, that was you?
Dang.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, playing music on the speakerphone in any way, whether it's a watch or a phone. In a public setting, I don't think is entirely appropriate. And I don't think playing music on a speakerphone at home is entirely appropriate either. I think you want to get headphones, man, or get some speakers.
Right. Well, it's not ideal, but there are certainly people who play music from their smartphone speakers, and it doesn't seem out of the ordinary that someone would extend that to a smartwatch.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so anyway, the last one here is somebody used a QR code on the watch to check into an airplane terminal.
And now, that seems like a great idea.
Yes, I agree that it seems like a great idea. It's not something that we're going to see for a very, very long time, if smartwatches even take off in the first place. But that one...
Oh, take off. That was clever, because I'm sure the TSA will make you take off the watch.
Nice. So I just think you're not going to see it anytime soon. But I do like the kind of vision that encompasses, right? I do like that as an idea, as opposed to the other two that I just brought up.
Sure. Well, this ad really is just more of a proof of concept than anything else. And it's showing people in public spaces being able to use this watch.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. And again, I like the vision. I'm not sure the couple things that I just mentioned there will go anywhere. But the watch as an area for Google Now notifications strikes me as completely awesome. So let's talk a little bit about the renders from the LG and the Motorola devices. We've got two of them here. Let's take the Motorola device first. It's called the Moto 360, and it's kind of this round, slightly chunky, yet stylish-looking kind of watch. It's got what appears to be a leather band on it, and I think the industrial design is well done, albeit a little bit chunky.
Sure, it looks fantastic, I think, and some people like having a chunky watch, and yeah. I think that lends itself well to this sort of first-generation technology of trying to pack a lot of new technology into this watch. The main thing I'm curious about or concerned about is that Motorola has this circular watch face, whereas LG and most of the other companies who've talked about what they're going to do with Android Wear have square watch faces, like the Pebble or
right.
whatever else is out there. But I wonder if Google or any of these companies have a plan for differentiating between circular displays and square ones.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. You know, we talk about what it means to have a responsive web page that resizes itself for mobile and desktop browsers. Are we going to have a circular, square, responsive smartwatch app? That seems a little insane.
Yeah, I think we will, and I think it could take years to figure out how to do it properly.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought.
So it'll be a while before they can square the circle on that one.
So all we know about some kind of release date is that Motorola has said that they will have, quote, a variety of styles globally in summer 2014. So actually, that is pretty soon. From what I can tell, this is kind of in a design phase, proof of concept, but apparently it's a little bit further than that.
Yeah, I mean, Google is just announcing a platform now, and it's great that they have enthusiastic hardware partner support, but unless you're a true early adopter, I would not even consider buying any of these products until 2015.
Now, I mentioned this on Twitter when I saw this news. I was imagining tying a smartwatch into your home automation system and how awesome that could be.
Sure, that could be pretty awesome.
Yeah, I think those two things kind of marry together very well. You know, you forget to turn off a light or whatever, you just kind of flip your wrist up and turn it off or whatever it is. But I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
Yeah, it could be. It depends on what kind of connectivity the watch has, and it'll probably take some doing to get it integrated with a smart home system. But yeah, but there are a lot of potential there.
Yeah, definitely. So Taylor, you will be writing that application for us, right?
Yes, absolutely. So when there is a common smart home system and a smart watch system.
Oh yeah.
Made by Apple.
That's
both of them have to be made by Apple, otherwise I won't write it.
You're gonna be waiting a while for that one. So the one concern that really strikes me as being serious is having a color LCD on your wrist like this is going to have battery implications. I can't imagine that they can get this device in with a reasonable battery life.
Yeah, well, I would imagine that it would follow the trend of a lot of smartphones and tablets now, and that the thing's going to end up being mostly battery, and the most of the rest of it is display. But you'd need a really power-efficient battery, and I mean, I think the goal here initially would be just to reach one full day of use.
Yeah, that's got to be the goal, right? Just one day. So hopefully they have some kind of Qi wireless charging or something. That would really blow me away if that were the case.
Oh, I think they could. I think someone will. One of these manufacturers will definitely be doing that in the first or second generation.
Yeah. So I'm encouraged from what I see, and I am eagerly awaiting the smartwatch era. I don't think it's our next smartphone moment, but I think it's a good addition to the extension of the explosion of smartphones in recent years.
Yeah. My favorite promotional photo here from Motorola is a rendering that shows a bicyclist getting turn-by-turn navigation on his watch. That's really cool. It's turn-by-turn has come to cars, but it's hard to implement it for bikes.
Yeah, I wonder if you can match it with an earpiece or something.
Maybe.
All right, well, let's get into some gaming news. We've got some Sony news. What's going on with Project Morpheus?
Well, Project Morpheus is the new reveal from Sony. They are introducing a VR headset, right? So they're trying to compete with Oculus Rift and trying to bring virtual reality gaming into the forefront. So Project Morpheus is going to be a headset that connects to the PlayStation 4. They have a prototype that they're already demoing. And it has a 1080p LCD built in, and you can turn your head 90 degrees, so 45 degrees to the left or to the right, and be able to have a fully articulated view of everything that's within those 90 degrees.
Yeah, it seems like a very interesting project. You know, I think the virtual reality thing has kind of come back up, and we've now got the technology to actually do it correctly.
Yeah, we're just getting there.
Uh-huh. And
so,
you know,
for example, this headset is it's still a really heavy, bulky headset, but they've designed it in such a way that the weight doesn't bother you or weigh down on the bridge of your nose. It uses your whole head for support.
Right. And I think this could be interesting, but it's still kind of in the prototype phase. They're not looking to make a consumer project of it this year. They're still kind of exploring what the possibilities are.
Yeah, and we don't even really know what those possibilities are going to turn into when this actually hits the market.
Yeah, and we've got these things have to be wireless. It's not going to catch on if there's wires hanging out the back of your head like a Borg.
And as of now, the Project Morpheus is wired.
Right.
It's not just one wire, but it has HDMI and USB.
Yeah, and that's to be expected in the prototype phase, right? You're not going to expect that kind of polish in this phase, but it's cool to see that they're thinking about it.
Yeah.
So, Microsoft, it's your move.
Sony, it's your move.
Tying together Kinect and a VR headset, wouldn't that be crazy?
What was the company that's their motto was, it's in the game?
EA Sports.
EA Sports? Well, now, the game is in you.
EA Sports. The game is in you. All right, let's take that and move right into the afterburners, speed up our pace a little bit. Taylor, do you have your seatbelt securely fastened?
I do. Do you? Are we ready to go?
I think we are.
All right, so a couple of weeks ago, we reported on Newsweek's supposed scoop that they had discovered Dorian Satoshi Nakamoto as the man who claimed to be the creator of Bitcoin. Now, we just wanted to follow up on this story. We weren't sure if Newsweek was right or not, but he has come out publicly and said, I did not create, invent, or otherwise work on Bitcoin, and I unconditionally deny the Newsweek report. So he's saying it's not him, and we're pretty much going to leave it at that.
So Intel is releasing a bunch of new chips that are kind of an iteration on the old Haswell architecture. They're calling this the Core i7 Extreme Edition. It's based on Haswell E architecture. And apparently these things are going to be overclock friendly. And at least for now, we've got 8 cores inside of a desktop processor. We've had those kind of processors in server boxes for a while now, but haven't seen it often in desktops.
Yeah, they released some desktop chips early on in the Haswell architecture, but right. Now they've upgraded that architecture and allowed it to be a lot more extensible. And so this is geared towards performance desktop end users.
And no integrated graphics.
No, because if you're buying this kind of chip, you're definitely going to want your own set of graphics.
BYOGC. It's a bring your own graphics card.
Nice. All right. Well, Apple's iPad 2 that they started selling in April 2010 is finally being retired. They are no longer offering it now for the same price, $399 and up. Before you could get the iPad 2, they are reintroducing the iPad 4. That was the latest generation before the iPad Air. It has the same form factor as the iPad 2 and 3, but the Lightning port and upgraded processor of the iPad 4 and close to the iPad Air.
And Tumblr is getting a little bit of security with two-factor authentication. We see website after website adding this kind of authentication, and it's a good security practice for those who are seriously concerned about security. So they've implemented this in the way of texting, or you can use something like Google Authenticator. And it's good to see a lot of the major websites out there jumping on this bandwagon.
Cool. And now for Chrome on Windows and Mac, you can have access to Google Now. That's their contextual push cards and voice search. And their Chromium builds have had this for a while, as well as their mobile apps. And now it is being rolled out to the stable channel, which means that all versions of Chrome will be updated to include this automatically in the next few weeks.
Yeah, and I have my Chrome open right now, and I don't have it quite yet, so I'm sure it'll be coming down the pipe pretty soon.
Okay, so we've mentioned the hashtag music app for iOS by Twitter. This was Twitter's idea that you could use your Twitter account and the collected information of Twitter users to find out what the most popular music is, and then just go to the iTunes music store and buy that music. Never really caught on. For reasons that I think are fairly obvious, and they have pulled it from the App Store and are going to completely cease functionality by April 18th. Few people will mourn its passing.
And Amazon is going to be raising the price of its Prime service from $79 a year to $99 a year. That will take effect on April 17th. So if you're renewing your Prime membership before April 17th, you're going to get the old price of $79. After April 17th, you're going to get $99. So,
but if you're trying to sign up new and you wanted to get that $79 price, you are too late.
Right. It is already taken effect. So I've had the service for a while, and I think Amazon didn't quite know what to charge for it. And this is them kind of actually doing the math and figuring out exactly what makes sense. And it's a pretty hefty price increase, so I don't know what I'm going to do about it. We'll see.
Well, when they started offering it for $79 a year, there was a lot less online content that they were offering.
True, you are getting more nowadays.
Right. I mean, they didn't have their own original series that you could stream for free. Apparently, there's a lot of other stuff that you can stream for free to your computer or to any number of Kindles that they offer. So, you know, they're always offering more things, and it's too bad that they're raising the price, but it makes sense.
Yeah, I almost wish that they would separate out the videos and the shipping aspects of it, and just have one for $80 and one for $99 or something like that.
They should do that. Why don't they do that?
Yeah, I don't know. You'll have to talk to their economics department over there. All right. So let's go off to Seattle to talk to Amazon. And in the meantime, Taylor, you can undo your seatbelt and get a gin fizz as we exit the afterburners.
Okay. Well, as you know, it will take 2.5 minutes to make a proper gin fizz.
Okay, so in the meantime, I will get into our next story, which is the first of the end user stories. And we've got some kind of interesting thing going on in BitTorrent land. So there's an application out there called Popcorn Time. And this is an application that allows you to look at a cover of a bunch of movies, and you can select a movie, and it will automatically pirate it via BitTorrent, download it in the background, and stream it as if it were Netflix. So it's kind of a mirage of Netflix that's peer-to-peer and is part of BitTorrent. And by the way, is completely illegal and should not be used. It is definitely kind of sketchy to have that kind of behavior. But what I thought was kind of interesting just about the coming and going of this application, because at this point in time it's been at least put up on the internet somewhere and then taken down. That's happened at least twice at this point in time. So you know, with applications that highly encourage illegal activity like this one does, that is not entirely a surprise. So I'm sure that will continue to keep happening. But the thing that I kind of take away from this is, this is kind of hiding all of the messiness of going to find a BitTorrent site out there and getting the BitTorrent and downloading the BitTorrent. It's
sure, it's a messy
that
process.
Yeah,
but
it's not going to
stop anyone who's looking for it.
Right, but this is completely hiding all of that complexity. I feel like one of the only reasons the unsophisticated masses don't get into BitTorrent, aside from its illegality, is that, you know, it's complicated. It can be very complicated to figure that stuff out. And this completely removes that barrier. And of course, that's why it was removed, right? But the thing that kind of stuck in my head is that really, technology waits for no one. Here's an application that provides free, albeit illegal, access to a bunch of illegally pirated content in the easiest way possible. And I've got to think, you know, there's got to be some way that we can leverage this technology for something that is not completely illegal. And we've got this technology that allows us to have these kind of peer-to-peer networks, and there's got to be something that we can do with it instead of just trying to play whack-a-mole and, you know, bop this application amongst many others on the head as they come out. There's got to be something that the studios can do to leverage this kind of technology. And, you know, if I knew what it was, I would be a very rich person. So I get that part of it. But they're just the whack-a-mole game is a losing proposition for the movie studios and, to a lesser extent, the music labels out there. And it just occurs to me that this is kind of a fantastic technology for distributing this kind of video content. And
right. I'm sure just by the nature of using BitTorrent as a backend, it's much more efficient at streaming this content than YouTube or Netflix could possibly be.
So, yeah, I don't know. I don't quite know how these two things run together, but there's got to be some way that somebody can use this for something that's not a complete piracy program, right?
And right. You're absolutely right. I think the way to move forward is not to fight the technology, because that just won't work.
Yeah.
The technology's here. It can't be, you know, you can't put a cap back on that bottle. But we saw this over 10 years ago with MP3s. The ability to have an easy portable file format that could easily be distributed over the internet led to a flood of piracy of music. People started taking music because it was easier to use Napster than it was to get music just about any other way, including going to a store and buying a CD.
Right.
And eventually that got shut down, but it never completely went away, and it was only defeated in any sense, not because they were suing everyone who was downloading songs, which they tried and it still failed, but because the legal technology for you to be able to purchase music, pay the content owners for it, and get it and listen to it immediately became as easy as, and eventually easier than, going to Napster or whatever program they had at the time and getting it. And so I don't see any reason conceptually why you couldn't take this technology and apply the same principles to it. If movie studios and TV studios and content producers and owners can leverage this technology to make it easy for people to get what they want at a fair price, then people will be willing to do that. There will still be some piracy. You can't get rid of it completely. But there are a lot of pirated DVDs out there, too. And I don't see SWAT teams going after street vendors for them.
Right. And I think ultimately you're right. We're going to slowly over time, we're going to realize that all of the craziness around online video is going to kind of subside, and we're going to have an easier way to get at that kind of content.
Yeah. This app is illegal, but it's a very easy and efficient way to get this content.
Yeah, that's why it was so provoking to me is, you know, I realize we shouldn't go and get this and actually use it to watch movies. But I thought from an industry perspective, it was very interesting what our current technology is capable of and how that technology is completely squandered by people in the movie industry. And there's something we could do with this, and I don't know what.
I think there are lots of things that we can do with this, and the market will eventually figure that out.
Yeah, yeah. So, last thing, by the way, it's for those interested, it is a Node.js app. If you want to see how it is put together, if you're a developer or something, it is still up on GitHub, so go have a look. All right, so let's move into some Mozilla news. They've got a CEO shakeup. Their CEO, Gary Kovacs, is stepping down, and their current CTO, Brian Aich, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his last name. He's the current CTO. He's going to be stepping up into the CTO or the CEO position. And he is one of the guys that had a hand in inventing the JavaScript language. So that's the in-browser scripting language. So he's got some technical chops, no matter what you think of JavaScript in the end. And I thought we'd mention that in kind of an afterburner style, because ultimately the CEO of Mozilla doesn't have a whole lot of end user kind of impact, right? I mean, they will be making decisions that have the end user impact, but what does have some the end user impact is the arrival of Firefox 29 beta, which seems like a very interesting development to me. It's called Aurora, and this is going to be one of their overhauls to the user interface of Firefox. And from what I can see, they're taking some of the good bits of Chrome and kind of expanding on that idea.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to try out the Beta 29, but it does look really pretty cool. I like the way that they're going with it.
Yeah, so basically, they're moving the menu button over to the right, just like it is in Chrome. They're rounding the tabs off, just like Chrome does. They're adding some syncing capabilities, which apparently were in Firefox OS, but not in the main Firefox browser. And they're adding some more, you know, CSS3 and HTML5 features that are continuously flowing into the browser. So I've always, for whatever reason, I'm not sure if it's Firefox's way of working or not, but for whatever reason, I've always resonated with Chrome. Every time I went to use Firefox as my main browser, I always ended up running back to Chrome. And I don't know if it's because Chrome is the right way to do a lot of this stuff, or if I'm just used to it. But for whatever reason, I always came running back. So I'm glad to see some of those features get pushed down into Firefox as well.
Well, one feature that they are not pushing forward with is the Windows 8 mode for modern UI. That's their new interface for Windows 8 and Windows RT with the tiles and everything. So they have their... you could explain it better than I do, Chris. But apps have to have a separate interface in order to work with the modern UI, formerly called Metro, right?
Yeah, this has been kind of a weird thing, and Chrome is doing this now where they give you this kind of pseudo-desktop thing browser in the Metro environment, and it's kind of a weird workaround because you have to have the desktop Chrome installed to use the Metro version of Chrome, but it's likely that the people using the desktop version of Chrome are in fact not going to be using the kind of Metro touch-like features of Windows 8. So it's kind of a no man's land. And Firefox just decided, let's not even go there. It's still too weird to do that kind of thing. And I got to imagine if the Metro stuff takes off a little bit more that they would reconsider this. But for the moment, it looks like it just doesn't make sense to do that. And unfortunately, it's going to be difficult for them to implement a browser on the tablet version, you know, on the Surface RT and the like, because you don't get the desktop APIs that they are currently using with their code base. So they're kind of just going to have to wait until the developer story for the Metro environment gets a little richer. And I've got to imagine that will happen over time, but it's definitely not there yet to implement something like a full browser. So they've just decided to hold off for the moment instead of what Chrome is doing. And I think for the moment, that is probably a good decision.
Yeah. So Firefox had in their beta version, their previous beta version, a Metro mode shell just like Chrome had, but they've decided to hold off, and so they've removed it from both the beta and the full version.
Yeah, and like I said, I think for the moment that makes sense. And he's also noting that the Metro mode only had about 1,000 users every day. So when you're talking about something at the scale of Firefox, that's not a lot.
Yeah, sure.
All right, well, let's get into our green tech story of the week. You've got us covered. What do you got?
Okay, so this story is a little bit meta. It's an article from Ars Technica generated through some chatter by a popular article in The Economist about a few recent studies that were determining the relationship between human activity and the sensitivity of the climate. Does that make sense? Right? So how much we do and how much that affects the climate of the Earth. What's the amplifier effect of our actions, our carbon emissions, our reshaping of our own climate, and how that affects the Earth long term? So there were a bunch of recent studies that came up with relatively low values for that, meaning our long term impact on the climate would be mitigated in terms of these effects because the Earth was just more resilient than we thought. However, these studies turned out to be flawed. Does that make sense? So the studies that said that our actions were having a small impact on the climate were flawed, and there are plenty of other studies that show that our climactic impact is large.
So these were unable to be reproduced with third parties.
Right, these particular studies that showed that the impact was low. I mean, it's not necessarily that they were non-reproducible. It's just that they appear to be the result of natural variability.
Right. So you could look at it and say, okay, that is in fact what the measurements showed, but it happened to be in a time span that...
that showed lower than the actual measurement, right, or than the actual value of that data.
Yeah, trying to measure data of this scale is a very hard problem.
It is. I mean, and it's a problem that we've only been working on for a few decades. And that is not long at all when it comes to the time scale that we're trying to measure.
Yeah, so I guess point being is that we should look at some of the other data that we have available to us and discount these. And that's the way science works, right?
Exactly. That's the way science works. It's just the sensational nature of the news that we receive today tends to focus on the most recent studies, and several of these most recent studies found out to be flawed. And that's the point that I'm trying to make. And I think this matters, as obviously I'm an environmentalist, but we here at the Digital Media Zone talk about technology in contexts that range from what computer and what smartphone you're going to buy or what software to use to what car you buy or how your home is wired or whether you should buy a new home or an old home based on how it can be configured. These are things that we all think about. And if in thinking about your entire digital life, you're wondering whether your carbon footprint is going to make an impact on the world at large while you're living your life and using all of these technologies, the point of this story is that all of the evidence that we have so far says that it should matter to you. And so that's the end of my environmentalist rant for the week.
All right. Well, so let's pick it right on up with the tip of the week. And you've got some more two-factor options for us. What is this site here?
Right. Well, we mentioned earlier in the show that Tumblr has just introduced two-factor authentication. And so that might have you wondering, you know, hey, what sites have added two-factor authentication? Where can I be more secure? If security is your focus, two-factor authentication is a great way to enable it and make sure that basically no one can steal your passwords or your account info, or at least make it a lot harder.
Yeah, I like the graph in the story. It says, you know, so-and-so, check. So-and-so, Google Auth, check. You know, SMS, check. X, so on, telling you what is supported and what is not supported. And then on some of them, it's just a big blue bar, and it says, tell them to support two-factor authentication.
Right, it makes it really easy. I guess they let you just send a tweet directly from the website telling these companies to support two-factor authentication. Yeah, but it is a really nice, simple, comprehensive chart, and you can see that whole chart and tweet at the companies that don't support it at twofactorauth.org. That's twofactorauth.org.
And staying with the security bent, we've got some ways to protect yourself at a coffee shop. What kind of VPN providers are we looking at here?
Well, we're looking at Lifehacker's top five best virtual private network providers, paid VPN providers, as selected by their users. And they have a good mix here. Private Internet Access is a company offering VPN services that I just tried out personally this week, and they seem to be pretty great. TorGuard, IPVanish, and CyberGhost are the other three paid options that they recommend. And the last one that they suggest is to do it yourself. Basically, if you have any sort of computer that you can set up as a server, you can run it as a VPN back to your own home network and have always private, protected, home-based internet access from anywhere.
Yeah, and that's what I do. I have my Windows Home Server 2011 box hanging around that I set up a VPN server on. I've actually got a post up on the Digital Media Zone about how to do that. And so whenever I'm in a coffee shop and I need protection from the people who are adjacent to me on the network, I just kind of VPN home and go from there. And that doesn't protect you from your ISP snooping on what you're doing. So if that's a concern, you want to do something else.
Right.
But
your
in general,
ISP snoops on you because your traffic is still being routed through your home network.
Right.
So your home ISP is the one who's snooping on you.
But presumably you have less to worry about with your home ISP than just sitting next to some random person in Starbucks or whatever. So I always try to remember to VPN home whenever I'm using open Wi-Fi somewhere, just to protect me from the people that are adjacent to me in the coffee shop. If you know you're only doing stuff over HTTPS, that is also absolutely secure from the people around you. So depending on what you're doing, you kind of get the option of whether or not you want more protection than what is provided by the service you're using.
But these paid VPN services, such as privateinternetaccess.com, will allow you to have security even from your own ISP.
Right.
So when I set it up before, on the OS X app, it gives you a little option in the menu bar, and you click connect, or you can even select from a list of about 25 servers based on location. So you can pick different locations in different states or countries and connect to that. And then if you check your IP address after connecting to that, your computer and your ISP will think that you're logging in from Switzerland or wherever you happen to choose.
So I just realized this is a little conspicuous of us. We're talking about Popcorn Hour, and our app pick of the week is a VPN solution. I assure you we didn't intend for that to be the case.
Well, it's also worth mentioning that using one of these VPNs, especially one that works internationally, will slow down your internet connection
significantly. Absolutely. Even with your home connection, if you have a home VPN server like I do, it'll still slow you down a little bit. So anyway, my long-running advice through this podcast still stands. Do not use Popcorn Time. It's illegal.
Can I just have some popcorn?
Yeah, you can have some popcorn. So if you did get some popcorn, I suppose you could sit down and play a goat simulator game. I think that would go good with popcorn. And perhaps a VPN. Maybe you're embarrassed that you're using the goat simulator game and you want to obfuscate the traffic that it puts out. So you want to VPN in, you want to get some popcorn, and you want to play the goat simulator game.
You should be embarrassed, Chris, because this particular goat simulator game is called Goat Simulator.
Yeah, and this is one of the most insane things I have seen in a long time. You absolutely are required to go through and watch the little YouTube video of the trailer of this game. It looks very interesting, to say the least.
It certainly does, yeah. And so the idea was just to take a GTA or Skyrim-style sandbox game and make it as big and as interesting as possible without focusing necessarily on the quality of the graphics or the physics, and then make the protagonist of the game a goat. And from there, it gets really glitchy and goofy in a way that's just really fun.
Yeah, it looks like the exact kind of absolute madness that the internet would come up with.
It does, yes.
So anyway, the meat of the story is in this video. So you have to go watch this video, and I apologize in advance for the music that's on the video. But we've got a link in the show notes, so check that out, follow through, and watch that thing. You'll like it. It's funny. So I'm going to level up my goat after this podcast.
Oh no, Chris, not you too.
All right, well, I think that'll do it for this week. So if somebody were to try to contact you on the internet at large, perhaps using goats, how would they go about doing this, Taylor?
Well, they would log into Goat Simulator, and then their goat would turn on their computer and then log into Twitter, and then the goat would tweet me at TaylorPhone, because that's totally a thing that a goat can do.
All right, and if you wanted to get at me and leave me some feedback about the show in some way, my Twitter handle is at Chris Hale Barnes, so feel free to hit us both up and let us know what you think of the show. Or if you just want to talk about goats, that's okay too. So let's get out of here. Thank you everyone for listening to the show, and of course you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, The Movie Podcast, and Home On. You can send us some feedback. We've got an email. It is theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us collectively on Twitter. We are at theenduser. You can join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.